then. I think we'll get started. We have Shaws is going to adhere to our instructions, I think, and talk about the things that are in the abstract, and then we're going to have a short talk from Dimitri Luam, because who's been doing some processing on a real biological project. And just before I get Shaw started, Linda Melanson is here, and she's demonstrating the soft, gentle blot of his on the CP3. If anybody wants a demo, just talk to Linda directly. And she'll be around this afternoon if you're interested in that. Okay, thank you very much, Shaws. Off you go.
Thank you, Bridget, also for the invitation. So, speaking about instructions, I thought I'd also put my questions up. So conventional ML3D, projection matching refinement, differences between them, Bayesian extension, how to avoid overfitting, model bias, and then multi-reference refinement classification. That struck me as somewhat different from all the other questions, because I only see answers here. So I don't know if that means everything has been answered. I don't think so, but you can form your opinion in the next hour or so. So I'd like to discuss the problem of single particle reconstruction from a theoretical point of view, because let's first do a bit of physics, because the electrons damage our material. We know we can't put many of them on the material. We have very noisy images. Then we need to defocus to get contrast with our faceplates, which leads to strong artifacts, which we model by this contrast transfer function, CTF. And then single particles, we have a rather crude way of preparing our grid. We just put a little drop and we blot it off. And then we can't control how all our particles orient themselves in the thin layer of ice or on top of a continuous carbon film. So we have unknown orientations and classes. So what I'd like to convince you of is that boils down to an incomplete ill-posed inverse problem. So that may sound difficult, but let's go through it one by one. So inverse problems are problems where the so-called forward model is very well known. And that's the case for a single particle reconstruction, where if you have a three-dimensional model of your protein, you can actually, in the computer, simulate electron microscopy images rather well. Okay, so we have a weak face approximation, so we can just take a projection of our three-dimensional map. So in Fourier space, that just means taking a two-dimensional slice out of the three-dimensional Fourier transform of your map. Then we have, until now, sufficiently accurate models of this contrast transpose function, at least to get to 3.3 angstrom resolution, which many of us would be happy with. And then our experimental projection is a CTF effect. Our experimental image is a CTF affected projection of this 3D model plus some noise. Okay, and then some people are very good at modeling noise, and some people have some more simple way. But you could simulate data to a pretty accurate extent. Okay, now the inverse problem lies in that the other way to go back from a bunch of two-dimensional experimental image to that three-dimensional model is much more difficult to do, okay? One of it is because we've only collected two-dimensional data, so that the three-dimensional information inherently has been lost in each individual 2D projection, okay? So that's an inverse problem. To go forward is easy, but to go back is not so easy, okay? Then the incompleteness lies in the fact that you could consider these problems as rather inconvenient one, where part of the data was not observed experimentally. In our case, the incompleteness lies in the orientations, and then if our protein of interest is one of these molecular machines which adopt different conformations or structural states, then also an assignment to each of one of those states you could consider as part of the data that would be great if we could somehow observe that experimentally, okay? And those incomplete problems in general are difficult to solve, and often iterative methods are employed. And the key point is, if the problem were to be complete, it would be really easy to solve, okay? If somehow our data collection in Legendon would put a little label next to each particle, what the angle, the orientation was in the class assignment, then doing reconstruction would really be much easier, and I'd be out of business. Okay? So incomplete data problems are all over science. And another famous one in structural biology is, of course, the crystallographic phase problem, where you only record intensities of reflections. But it would be so much easier if you could also somehow measure that experimental phase. Okay, so those two problems are very close together. And what binds them is this incompleteness of the data. Okay, so to illustrate that with some pictures, this is an incomplete data problem. There's noisy images of penguins here, and this is what we observed. Now, what we haven't observed was some in-plane rotation of these penguins. Okay, now that would then be the missing data. Okay, now if you'd like to get a good estimate of how a true penguin looks without the noise, okay, it's not so easy. Okay, wow, it's also not very difficult. What would be very easy is a complete data problem where somehow all these orientations would be known. If we could crystallize these penguins into a nice two-dimensional array where they're all in the same orientation, then or somehow we would know the orientation because Legendre told us so, then we can just average the signal together, and then you can, if you just assume that the noise is additive, you don't even need to assume it's Gaussian, then you can get to a pretty good estimation of the underlying penguin signal by just averaging over all the images. Okay, so complete data problems are really easy. Okay, so let's go back to what you can do if your problem is incomplete. Okay, so option one is to add the missing data to the model. Okay, the model we're after here is, how does a penguin look like? As a zoologist, I wouldn't be interested in how noisy images of penguins orient. I'm only interested in how the penguin looks like. So the missing data in itself is not of interest to me, but I could add it as some kind of pseudo things that I also need to learn, and you just add the parameters to the model. Okay. Now, a different option is to, and that's I call option two, is so-called marginalization, that rather than adding for each penguin an extra parameter, which was the in-plane rotation, we're going to calculate probabilities for all possible orientations of penguins, and I'm just going to calculate the probability of observing every penguin regardless of whatever that orientation was, and that regardless, in mathematical term, then boils down as an integration over all these orientations. Okay. Now, in the field, these two terms have become known. The first one has become known as maximum cross-correlation approaches, okay, where every experimental particle that we assign gets additional three orientations and two translations, and those are part of the model. Okay, we keep optimizing that. And in the field of crystallography, these methods have been called least squares. The two are very closely related, least squares refinements. Okay. Now, the second options in both fields have been called maximum likelihood methods. Okay. Now, let's first have a look at the maximum cross-correlation approach. I think the underlying statistical data model is such that our experimental image is this underlying true penguin image, which is here VK, to which we apply some rotation, which is notated by P of phi. Phi is the rotation angle. Okay, so the only thing that we need then to do is to find which is the orientation of our experimental image. Okay, now, then what you can do is alignment against a reference. So if you have some initial guess about the penguin, or perhaps you know it's a bird, and you can start with a parrot or so, then you can compare that initial guess of your model with each experimental image, and then you just calculate a similarity measure between the two, and cross-correlation has been popular. Okay, and then what you do, you just start searching this missing parameter, and you calculate this cross-correlation value for every possible rotation, and then one of them will fit best. Okay, so then what you can do, you can just plot rotation versus cross-correlation, and then where that becomes maximum, you say, oh, that's the best rotation, that will probably be the true rotation, okay? And then what you do that for all your experimental penguin images, so that hopefully they all become what we call aligned, and then we calculate the average of our experimental images, which will now hopefully be a better representation of a true penguin. It will look less like a parrot. And then, because it's better than what we started off with, you can actually iterate this, so that the next time, perhaps there were still some of the angles were wrong because they didn't read, the penguin is really quite different from a parrot, but you could then iterate it through, and hopefully you would get, in the end, to a nice and clean penguin image. Okay? So, the maximum likelihood approach is similar, okay? We will also iterate through our data. A fundamental difference is the statistical data model. We've seen before that we have a penguin image which needs to be rotated, but then the statistical model of the likelihood approach also explicitly takes the noise into account, okay? I've done that here by adding noise to our nice noiseless penguin, but it is a misunderstanding to think that inside maximum likelihood you add noise to reference projections, okay? We only model the statistical nature of the noise, the variance of the noise or whatsoever, okay? But and then you can use different models. Some are in real space, others in Fourier space, and whatever space we may come up with, which is better in the future, okay? But then if you use it in Fourier space, you can even model colored noise. But we typically assume the noise is Gaussian, okay? And that's for computational ease. So the fundamental difference is this statistical description of the noise. So then the maximum likelihood also starts with some initial guess of our penguin. So let's say that's our parrot again. And then, rather than calculating a cross-correlation coefficient between the experimental image and the initial model, we calculate a probability of observing this image given the parrot, okay? That's also just a value, just like cross-correlation coefficient could go from -1 to 1, the probability goes from 0 to 1, but it's just a number, okay? Now, what we do with this number is going to be slightly different, because we're going to calculate this probability for each possible rotation, and that I've tried to... let me see if I have more luck with the laser pointer today. I've tried to indicate with the kind of transparency of the picture here how high the probability is, okay? So here, rotating this penguin when it's upside up is the highest probability, because this rotation of the penguin resembles our model most, okay? But perhaps putting it upside down, because it's a bit of an elongated structure, still has significant probabilities. It wouldn't be zero, depending on how much noise there is in this image, okay? Now, and then what you do, rather than sticking with the best, which was what we do in maximum cross-correlation, that was what was called maximum cross-correlation, okay? Now, we sum all these different instances of the same experimental image together in the different rotations, but it's a weighted sum. And the weight is then directly the probability of observing the image given the parrot and given the certain rotation phi that we're using, okay? Now, if you do that for all the experimental images that we have, then again, in the end, we'll get something which looks more like a penguin than a parrot, because it's now a weighted sum of all our images, okay? But the fundamental difference between the two is only that rather than making discrete assignments of orientations, we now make fuzzy assignments or probability weighted assignments. Okay, so but again, because the after doing this once, the model is now better than the initial one. We just go back and we iterate our way through. Okay. So, if you want to think of this in an intuitive way, perhaps it's something like, if there's so much noise in the data that you can't really make out whether it's upside up or upside down, rather than having a lucky guess and which is based on a very noisy cross-correlation function, say, oh, I think it's up. Okay. Rather than just assigning that one as up, what you should do is, well, I'm not completely sure, so I'll just put both of them in. Okay, Yifan, you have a question?
Is the probability calculated based on cross-correlation?
It is, yeah, so the Gaussian noise model, so a Gaussian function has a square difference between the two images inside. And as you know, A minus B squared is A squared plus B squared.
Minus.
minus 2AB, okay? Now, this is what we call cross-correlation, okay? It's not the coefficient yet, but that's trivial then. Okay, so this goes inside your, a Gaussian function is something which has this term, right? Apart from some normalization, okay? There's a right step. So the cross-correlation, when this is high, then this, because of a negative, this is low. The square difference is small, and then if the square difference is small, this is a if this is B, then we have a Gaussian with sigma centered at A. So then the square difference is small, so A resembles B. So the probability becomes high. So cross-correlation is not the same as the probability, but it is directly related to, yeah. You can think of, there is just a function with an exponentiation which converts cross-correlation almost directly into a probability. Okay, so let's go on then. So those are the two, and that's then the main difference between the two methods. Does that then mean where these are completely different or whatsoever? Already from this discussion, you can intuit it's not completely different. They're very closely related. Actually, mathematically, they become identical in the absence of any noise in the data. Okay, so maximum cross-correlation refinement is a special case of maximum likelihood refinement where you assume there is no noise in the data. Yes. Yes. This integration over the missing parameter should be exhaustive. Hence, the slowness of my programs. Okay. So, I would say if you believe there is no noise in your data, you should go ahead and continue using maximum cross-correlation approaches. Okay. That's a joke. We wrote a review. Fred and I in methods and enzymology in Grant Jensen's book, which I recommend if you want to dive a bit more into the theory, okay? So now if we do three-dimensional refinement of our molecules, other than projection matching, it's very much comparable to this 2D alignment, okay? Only that now we have a three-dimensional transform of our model, and we have to compare two-dimensional Fourier transform of our images, which are slices through this transform. We just have to rotate all the way around, okay? And if you do maximum cross-correlation projection matching, then you just find the orientation that fits best in this transform, and then what you do, you sum all your images in this transform, and now P of phi is a projection operator, and the transpose of that would put the projection back in the 3D transform. So we get a sum of our two-dimensional transforms, all of which contribute with just in one orientation, which is the best one according to the cross-correlation function. Okay? And then if you want to take care of CTF, you have to multiply up above there by the CTF, you have to divide by the sum of the CTF squared. But that's perhaps too much detail. And again, if you start up with a three-dimensional parrot and you align all your two-dimensional projections of penguins, then after one iteration, the map will hopefully look more like a penguin, and you can do it again and iterate until things don't change anymore. Okay? So, and that then kind of boils down to doing a least squares solution to the problem, okay, which is a desirable solution. So in maximum likelihood, 3D refinement, and again, the analog will be clear by now. Rather than just summing the images each with one orientation, there is now again an integral over all possible orientations, and all orientations are weighted by their probability, which is this function gamma here. And as Mario pointed out, this integral should actually be over the entire domain, which is a five-dimensional function in 3D, and that's why things take their time. Okay. So you iterate this. Now theory says, and then you get to a maximum likelihood estimate of V. Theory now says that's the best one can do in the limit of infinitely large data sets. Okay? Perhaps Holber is the only one who approaches that, but even we can discuss that. Okay? There are some remaining issues which are quite important we should discuss. Okay? What to use as an initial guess, because this optimization algorithm that we're using, this iterative, is called expectation maximization, but it's basically just a local optimizer. So if the initial guess is pretty bad, if we started off with a three-dimensional lion, we may think up that we may end up with a penguin structure with four legs, and we may draw some rather biologically insane conclusions. Okay, so wrong initial model, because we're just doing a local optimization, can lead to wrong answer, okay? And how to distinguish a right answer from a wrong answer will be discussed more in more detail tomorrow, okay? We call this, to some extent, this is the model bias, okay? My thoughts on that, there's different ways to generate your initial model, okay? I think common lines models are cumbersome because they are made of class averages, two-dimensional class averages of your images, which are put together in some three-dimensional arrangement. But because those 2D class averages go in, projections of your 3D map in those directions kind of give 2D class averages which are present in your data. And only the combination of how they're put together is completely wrong, then this test, like, oh, projections of my model really resemble the 2D class averages I have in my data, are no longer always a good way of validating your structure, okay? And it can also lead to a very nasty local minimum, which is very hard to come out for the same reason. I think, well, one could be optimistic that it's better to do random conical tilt, or perhaps now that all these beautiful automated microscopy softwares are available, just collect some tomograms on your particles in negative stain, or if there's not too much flattening, and do some tomogram average. And then if you have a homologous structure, that often is the easiest route down. But, I mean, it also has its pitfalls. And then in my lab, I always encourage people to use EMAN to get away from an initial model which you have serious doubts about. In our hands, this is I think Steve has done a very good job in getting away from relatively bad models to a reasonable model. Okay, but also there, it's not guaranteed, but that's the way we do things. Okay. So, okay, that was what to use as an initial guess. Then what if multiple structures are present? Then we cannot just align against a single three-dimensional map, okay? Then, because we have an alignment plus a classification problem, the amount of missing variables is just increased, and the problem just becomes bigger, okay? And that's where three-dimensional classification comes into, and this is already rather old. This was together with Joachim while I was still in Carazo's group in Madrid. This was a reconstruction of 70S ribosomes, and then density for EFG in our single reconstruction appeared very fragmented. And if you looked at it in slices, also the 30S subunit looked rather blurred. Okay, so that was an indication that perhaps we were mixing together different states. So what you can do, we actually quite harshly filter such a consensus map, which has all the different states together. And then we take just four random subsets of our data, and we do a single iterations of the three-dimensional maximum likelihood approach to generate four random seeds. They're different because they're made from random subsets, but I don't claim there's much biological relevance in their difference. Okay, it's just a single iteration against four different random seeds. But what you can now do is align all your particles against the four models at the same time. And again, you take these probability-weighted angular assignments, but you complement that by also probability-weighted class assignments. So in the beginning, particles will more or less contribute equally to the four different classes because they're very similar. But you may hope that while you iterate this through multiple iterations, you can converge onto a state where the different conformations are separated out, because that will actually give you a higher likelihood value. Okay, and that's exactly what we see. So we got three of these four classes which converged to ribosomes with three tRNAs, and the other one had only one, but it had EFG inside. Okay, and that then coincided with supervised classification validating the new approach. Yes, Tom?
How do you figure out how many seeds to start with?
Yeah, good question. Typically, we just try many different runs with different numbers, and we stick with what we like best, which is not scientifically very satisfying, but it's the okay. So the old maximum likelihood programs, that was rather limited because of memory issues. I think the largest I ever done was six or so. Now in Relion, it scales much better with memory, so you can do many more. I think Arne just did 10 over the weekend or so. But I mean, that depends on how much RAM your computer has. Okay. And how much CPU you're willing to spend on it, okay? So, but And this, I think, the first point is very important. Often, my structure doesn't refine very well. I think I should classify it, okay? Perhaps your data is very bad and you should just collect new data rather than classify it, okay? It actually works well if there is a few well-defined structural states, okay? And I like two or three or four, okay? But if Tom discussed this, if there's continuous heterogeneity, then classification in a discrete number of subsets will always be a compromise between how many images contribute to each class and how much is the remaining variability inside that class, okay? I haven't seen any satisfying solutions to modeling some kind of continuous movement. I think that's mathematically quite difficult for single particle projections, but that we can discuss over beer perhaps. So if there's many states, you could find it. It may be tricky, but at least expensive. Perhaps supervising your classification and putting in prior knowledge of what you think might happen could be an alternative. And I think the most states done ever was done by Holber on the ribosome, where they have over 20 states, I think, out of 2 million particles, which I thought was beautiful work. So ultimately, also, this is a signal-to-noise ratio issue. So with our new detectors, with increased signal-to-noise ratios, we will be able to classify things that we couldn't classify before. Okay? So that's what we did. Then that last thing on the maximum likelihood, it's very nice, all the theory, but it only holds if the data set is infinitely large, had always been buggering me a bit. Okay? Because at the MRC, we don't have LegiNon. And we definitely do not collect infinitely large amounts of data. Okay, and that brings me to the third point that I mentioned in the beginning, which is the ill-posedness of the problem. Okay, and there is some pretty bad news in ill-posedness. Okay, because it means that the experimental data alone is not enough to determine a unique solution. Okay, there are many possible solutions to the problem. And That's pretty bad news if you come to think of it, because we want to choose the correct one, okay? And as a consequence of that, noise tends to accumulate in the reconstruction, because it's most obvious at high resolution, where we have less data compared to the number of model parameters. So especially at high resolution, there's so many noisy states that are equally likely in the light of our data than the correct one, that becomes a problem, okay? And that then can lead to overfitting, overestimation of resolution, and completely wrong interpretations of your map. Okay. Now, the good news about ill-posed problems is that very often you can rephrase an ill-posed problem by incorporating prior information you may have about the problem, so that you can get a different problem which is no longer ill-posed, meaning it now has a unique solution. Okay. Now, that in general is called regularization. Okay. And one could think of the conventional methods that people have been using in the field, and Powell has described many of them in great detail. You could think of it as regularization, and Wiener filtering and low-pass filtering are perhaps the two most powerful tools in the box. Okay, so the two-dimensional Wiener filter makes some statistical assumptions about our data. It assumes that noise is independent. It has a certain power spectrum, function of resolution, and it also assumes actually that the signal is independent with a certain power spectrum as well. Okay, now then there's beautiful theory, and you can read Powell's papers about it, that you can minimize the noise in a 2D average, and minimizing the noise then means it's the optimal filter. Okay, by doing this complicated division. Okay, but it's many of you may have seen it. You do summation of the images, which are multiplied by the CTF, and you divide by something which is sum of the CTF squared plus an additional term. Okay. Now and then, if you do things correctly, there's the ratio of the power signal, the power of the signal, and the power of the noise in those terms as well. Okay. So this does mean, because the spectral signal to noise ratio dropped very quickly on our images, this means that the 2D Wiener filter not only corrects for CTF, and that's what it's famous for, okay, it also acts as a low-pass filter, okay, because tau squared drops with nu much faster than sigma squared. Okay, So it's and that's logical, because an optimal filter shouldn't give you something which is very noisy. It should remove noise, okay? So for the 3D Wiener filter, Powell reviewed this in 2010, I think we didn't really get to a satisfying definition of the 3D filter or how to handle this, okay? So the same assumptions hold as before, but what we now often, many people have done to make these things tractable or easily computable, is let's assume that the spectral signal-to-noise ratio is a constant, okay? And that constant then goes, then these nasty tau squared over sigma squared disappear from the equation, and you replace the plus one by a plus c, and that c has then been termed the Wiener constant, okay? Now, that has a problem, because the spectral signal-to-noise ratio in your data is far from being a constant. Everybody knows there's quite a bit of signal at low resolution, that's why we can see our particles, and then when we go to high resolution, there's nothing left in an individual image to see it, okay? Only by averaging over thousands of them we can get that out. So this is not true, and that means if you use a Wiener constant, that the low-pass filtering effect of the Wiener filter gets lost. So we still correct for the CTF, those terms have survived, but the low-pass filtering effect has been lost, okay? So we've made a compromise to theory, and therefore our Wiener filter only does one of the two tasks. It corrects for CTF, but it no longer low-pass filters. So, I mean, the field has been well aware of this, so then what you do, you use an arbitrary low-pass filter, and there's many different shapes implemented in different programs, and then the only thing you have to do is choose the optimal shape and the effective resolution, the width, etc. Okay? Now, if you're good at that, then that's a very reasonable thing to do, and you can get a very good reconstruction, and many structures in the EMDB are evidence of that, okay? It does have a problem, though, that an expert user has to do this, because if you're bad at it, things can go pretty wrong, okay? So that introduces subjectivity in the structure determination process, which is something I think is we should avoid, okay? Now...
Excuse me. May I inject that this is not quite right?
I wouldn't doubt you would inject. Yes.
Separation between Wiener filter and low-pass filter. Again, if you talk to Steve, it's done somewhat differently, but generally, the way I do it is that the low-pass filter, which you say arbitrary, it's easy to show that it's given by the F-seeker. Essentially, you multiply by the F-seekers. So if F-seeker is arbitrary, then I agree, your filter is arbitrary.
Yes.
No,
I don't say that there aren't better ways of doing it than using an arbitrary shape, and I don't say everybody uses an arbitrary shape. Well, it depends on the implementation, okay? For example, in XMIP we used something which was a raised cosine function. I think Spider uses Butterworth functions, or I mean.
I mean, something you need,
what
you claim,
which I'm not aware of. Okay, good. So I don't say everybody does this in a suboptimal or an arbitrary way. I say some methods cut corners with theory, which then need to be corrected at other points. Okay, and in the end, I think we have very flexible workflows, beautiful scripts in Spider and so on, and people can choose too many things, and user expertise is required to get a good resolution, which is something I'd like to avoid. Okay. Now, a Bayesian statistical view on regularization is if we now extend our likelihood function with prior information, then we can do something which is called maximum a posteriori or MAP estimation. I won't go into the details, but again, the assumptions are very similar to the Wiener filter. We again assume that the noise is independent, although an additional assumption is it's now also Gaussian, okay, and it has a certain spectral power. We'll skip over the equations. Now, we assume that the signal is also independent, just like in the Wiener filter, and the additional assumption here as well is that the signal is Gaussian distributed, and it has a limited power. Now, the limited power in the Fourier transform means that it's relatively smooth in the real domain. And that's, I think, a good intuitive way of understanding this method is that you, in the real domain, you impose smoothness on your maps. So you don't want very spiky, noisy maps. You want maps where the density varies smoothly as a function of the coordinates. Okay? So if you put all that together and you optimize using the same function using the same algorithm that we use to optimize the likelihood function, we get to this set of equations, and you don't need to go into too much detail. The important point are that this power of the noise as well as the power of the signal are estimated in an iterative manner from the data. So there's no user involved in doing that, and it's used to then construct the Wiener filter, where we actually now this sigma squared and the tau squared are still in there. Okay, so this Wiener filter, it's like a Wiener filter. It's actually, I think it's just an alternative derivation of the Wiener filter for 3D reconstruction, but this time so that the result is actually what it's intended to do. Okay, because sigma squared and tau squared are still in there, this function will both correct for the CTF and lead to the optimally filtered, low-pass filtered 3D map. A low-pass filter in this case is not just a one-dimensional curve, it's actually a complicated three-dimensional filter in the Fourier space, which depends on the orientational distribution of your particles, of possible astigmatism, and signal-to-noise ratio in your individual images. Okay, so that's good, because without any user intervention, we now have derived the optimal filter. So we've taken some of the responsibility of the user to tune things to go right out of the hands of the user, which is good for automation, but more importantly, is good for introducing objectivity in the approach. Okay, so let's recapitulate this point. Inverse problems needs iterating. Incompletes needs marginalization, which is this probability-weighted assignments of angles and possibly classes. And the ill-post problem needs regularization, which is the incorporation of prior information. In our case, the realization that maps are relatively smooth or they have a limited power spectrum in the Fourier domain. Okay, the Bayesian approach does all things at once in optimizing a single function. So I think the title of my talk was Optimizing Image Processing or so. I would say optimize a likelihood function, and then a regularized likelihood function does all these things. But I think the nice thing from a user point of view is that all these very crucial parameters are learned from the data. Okay, that's what Bayesian methods are good for. So there's very few ad hoc parameters for you to play with and thereby to make mistakes. Okay, now I want to make a little detour to on overfitting. This has now been published in Nature Methods. Because what people have been doing in the fields on how to estimate resolution, we kind of all knew that was cheating a little bit. Okay, we have a single model, which we do this projection matching. Then at some point, we need to have an estimate of resolution to apply a low-pass filter, which could be this arbitrary shape or FSC-based weighting, as Powell has rightly pointed out. Okay, now, how we get to this FSC curve, or this resolution estimate, was to, at the point of reconstruction, we quickly divided the data in two random halves and do a reconstruction of the two halves and calculate the FSC curve, filter our model, the reconstruction from all particles, and then continue with that single model. Now, the problem with that is that if noise somehow builds up in that single model, that at the point of dividing the data in two halves, you have because of noise bias, you have the same instance of noise in both half reconstructions, which leads to a FSC curve, which is partially caused, correlations in that curve are partially caused by noise rather than through signal, and thereby this curve can become inflated. Okay, we've called this overfitting. If you do this iteratively, it can go quite badly out of hand. And to illustrate that, I thought I'd just simulate some data so I know what's the truth, which is always a matter of discussion if we're speaking about true data. Okay, so 20,000, I used GROEL, simulated particles, and I did my best to do the noise spectra as realistic as possible. Then the reported FSC curve by the program, okay, by the conventional program, is the red one. And now Richard has suggested we should cut this curve at 0.143. Okay? If you do that, that's 4.6 angstroms. Some people have then argued that's really optimistic. Okay? And I understand many people like to cite his paper for it, but other people say, no, we are more careful. We will cut at 0.5, although there's theoretical indication you should do it at 0.143. I'll come back to that. So the problem is, if you now calculate the FSE between the reconstructed model and the known phantom that I used to simulate these images, and that curve you actually have to cut at 0.5, and I recommend Richard's and Peter Rosenthal's paper if you want to learn more about that. That actually says that the structures only correlate up to 8 angstrom with each other. Okay? Now, then what you often see, but then you get IC side chains. Okay? So it must be 4 point something angstrom. Okay? So I went into this map, and I had a quick look around. And I'll be fair with you, not all the map looks like this, but I could make a figure. Okay? Which shows these side chains, and I actually, the model is part of the real model that the PDB file that I used to generate these data, but I actually had to rotate and translate it a little bit. I call that conformational change from the simulated data to the reconstruction. Okay? But I showed this to several people, and they were convinced. This, they said, oh, you have done a really nice high-resolution reconstruction. I can see there is a side chain. I could see a bit of pitch in the helix and people. My point is, you can publish a structure where you can put an FSE curve and then people have become wary of FSE curves, but you also should show density. That is not enough. And your mind likes to see side chains because we're a beautiful Bayesian machine that works against prior knowledge, and we will find side chains in a noisy map. Okay? So this is the true map and the same model, and it has nothing to do with it. Okay? So all the side chains and the...
When you computed your FSC curve, did you do any masking?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Well, there's just a smooth, very wide spherical mask on it by default.
I'm just saying, so the map may actually be better in the case of simulated data in particular than your FSC versus the truth is leading you to believe in terms of reliability of the high density feature.
But the reference that your correlate gives has no noise in the background, so that should cancel out.
Yeah, there's no noise at all. Yeah.
No, but that doesn't cancel it out. It still comes in as noise in the FSC.
So my point is not about the exact values here, okay? It's obvious that the map is completely wrong, okay? It's very much overfitted on the left, and the correct one is on the right, okay? So now all these numbers we attach to it, you can tune your resolution by masking your maps before FSC. We all know that, okay? We should be careful. And because of that, we should be careful with that, okay? So we also have known for many years the solution to this, and I think Nico was one of the first to mention this in one of his papers. If you split the data into two halves that do not see each other, then this can't happen. So starting from an initial model, which is still common and is a theoretical weakness perhaps, but if you low-pass filter it to a very rigorous extent, I think it's in practice not much of a problem. We can then do two reconstructions in parallel. And if you would do the same procedure twice, the conventional procedure twice without them having to speak with each other, you would run into overfitting in one of them, overfitting in the other, and then in the end you would say, oh, the resolution is much lower, I have overfitted data. You can do one thing better, that is by every iteration, you compare these two half reconstructions, you calculate the FSC curve, and you use that to do FSC-based weighting, like Powell has just described, okay? Or some arbitrary shape, if you like, but it should be at a resolution where this FSC drops below 0.5. Okay, so if you do that and you could that converts, you'll be surprised how fast our refinements actually converge, because there is no more room for iteratively overestimating and inflating the noise in our map, which has been the cause of people. Oh, I will go a bit finer in angular sampling and do 5 more iterations, and the FSC curves will ever be higher. And people were spending many. I've seen publications with hundreds of iterations. Which, if you do this, you'll see it converges much faster. Then you end up with two models, and we're not interested in two models if we think the structure is homogeneous. But then what you can do, you can add them together, you get a twofold increase in the number of particles contributing to your reconstruction, and thereby a slightly higher resolution. But then you shouldn't use that map anymore to go back and do it all over again, because then it's just a more complicated procedure of doing what we had been doing before. Okay. Now, people were anxious to use that, because people would say, oh, now I have reconstructions from half of the data, That reconstruction will be worse than a reconstruction from the entire data set. So the angles that I get will be worse, and the resolution will be worse, and that's why it wasn't very popular. I also saw some examples of curves which illustrate that you could be tricked in believing that. However, as already pointed out by, was it Nico or some people, that the John, the low resolution frequencies actually drive the alignment, okay? And this is not something some people just say and then they do their own thing. This is really true. And you can, the great thing of simulated data, you can just show that because we know the true angle and see what kind of errors you see. You get, and you can actually compare doing reconstruction from the entire data set, how good are your angles, and how is that, does that compare to angles from half reconstructions, and in this case there is no difference at all, and that is because at low, relatively low resolution where these decisions are based on, there is virtually no difference between a half reconstruction and an entire data set reconstruction in practice. So if the orientations are as good as they would be from an entire reconstruction, there is no reason whatsoever to not use two independent models, okay? Because the quality of the orientation, if the signal-to-noise ratio of our data is a given, then it's only the quality of the orientations that determine the resolution we will get. So our hypothesis was that you will not get worse reconstructions if you do this. Okay, we tested that for several examples. I'll go through it quickly. It's all published now. The thing was, they all have high-resolution crystal structures available, so we could kind of check the truth. This is Groial. The red solid curve is the FSC curve from the conventional procedure, and this is the conventional map. The black curve is from the gold standard procedure, and this is the map. Okay, now you can choose which curve you want to publish, this one or this one. And if you look at the maps, even if you look at the maps, I would say, oh, I like this. I personally like this map better. And it definitely has more high resolution content than this map. Okay, and you see that it's true. So it's really, then you would be could be tricked into thinking, yeah, that is because the half reconstructions yield worse orientations. And you shouldn't do that. You should really do what we've been doing for many years. But if you now calculate the Fourier correlation between both maps and the crystal structure, then you can see they correlate up to the exact same resolution. Okay? And what is more, and that brings me back to the 0.143 criterion. This curve, if you cut it at 0.143, it's somewhere around here, it's more or less where the FSC where the crystal structure goes through 0.5.
Could you just repeat which curve is which?
Black is gold standard. Red is the what I call suboptimal procedure. And then the dashed lines are the FSCs against the crystal structure. Again, black, gold standard, and red, suboptimal procedure. Okay? So it seems you get lower resolution, but that's not, it's not the true resolution, is the same. Okay, and for hepatitis B, these are capsids from Tony Crowther, you get the same. Overfitting is much less because this is icosahedral symmetry. There are less parameters to observation, so things are better behaved. But still, the curve itself shifts quite a bit. And then beta-galactosidase, and Richard showed some of these data yesterday, it's getting even better. So there is a lot of overfitting, okay, if you think, if you compare the suboptimal FSC curve with the black FSC curve, and you can see there's many more high-resolution features in this map than in this map. But there's something suspicious. If this would have been your refined structure, and you'd like to publish it, you should be already suspicious about this map. Okay, if you look at your map in slices, which I think is often very informative way of looking at your map rather than just looking at it in Chimera, okay? You can see all these little things, all these spikes coming out. Now, solvent does not have spikes, okay? Solvent should be flat. So if you get spikes running out of your reconstruction, I think that's a pretty good indication you're overfitting your data, okay? And if you go to the EMDB, there are surprisingly many spikes containing structures there, okay? This map, if you look at it, it looks much worse than this map. Okay, and the FSC curve is definitely much worse. But if you compare this map with the crystal structure, you get this black dashed line. If you compare this map with the crystal structure, you get this one. So because the orientations have now become worse, because they've partially been driven by these overfitted spikes in the solvent, you've actually ended up with a worse structure. So although you can say it's much higher resolution, it is actually much worse. Okay, and that's the real trap of overfitting. You're not just fooling yourself with a number assigned to it. You may actually end up with a completely wrong or at least a much worse structure than you could have. Okay, so the conclusions of that is that you can avoid overfitting without loss of resolution. Okay, and one way is to do it is this gold standard FSC, just have two independent refinements. Another way would be to limit the high resolution components that go into your alignment, and then at the end, reconstruct from all your data and see the FSC curve between that. I think both models are, both approaches are equally valid. I kind of like the gold standard FSC. But and in the absence of overfitting, you may actually get a higher resolution map, a true higher resolution, and they're extremely clean. These maps, there's no more staring into lots of noise and having a lot of trouble fitting and building models. Okay, these maps are really clean because you have a true estimate of its signal-to-noise ratio, and I will show you examples of that. And if you do this, then use 0.143 FSC criterion. I've heard of somebody who had a paper in review, and he'd done the gold standards, and he was cutting at 0.143. Then the reviewer said he should not use 0.143, but 0.5. Okay, then you're cutting yourself, you're shooting yourself in the foot. So if you're a reviewer, do not say that to people if they've done gold standard FSCs, okay? So let's go back to the statistical approach, because this overfitting you can do in any package, okay? And I know Steve has been working in Eman, but it could be done in spider scripts. The results I presented were actually XMAP, IPSMIP refinement. You can do this in any package, okay? So I did the same in the Bayesian approach. And you can actually convert these gold standard FSC curves then to estimates of the power of the signal, which is what we do. And that's all implemented in a program called RELION, which stands for Regularized Likelihood Optimization. And you can download it from that URL. I did a demonstration of this 2 days ago. So I want to show you some results. And Tom said, test new programs on all data, well, not all the old data, but data that you control. You know what you should do, okay? So that's what I did. So first thing is, RELION also does this multi-reference alignment where you can classify structures in 3D. And we just thought, well, then we'll just test it on the benchmark, which is actually a subset of the data set I showed previously with the ribosomes with and without EFG that Joachim Frank kindly submitted to the EBI, and people can just download. And many new classification approaches have used this benchmark to test how well they were doing. Okay, and everybody with their unsupervised classification approach found what they were supposed to find, which was about half of the particles with EFG and half of them without it. Okay, now if I do this map refinement with four classes, I actually get three different classes. Two of them, which together add up to about half of the particles, have EFG. Then there is a 42% class which does not have EFG, but there are actually 6% of the images which are large subunits which were present in the benchmark but nobody had picked up. Okay, the reason why nobody had picked this up is if 6% of 10,000 is only 600 particles. Okay, and a reconstruction from 600 particles, if you're not careful in filtering it, it becomes very noisy. Okay, because the filter for the four independent for the four simultaneous model is optimized internally in RELION. RELION sees that, oh, there's only 600 particles, then the summation in the term hits a point much sooner. And what it is in practice happens is that this map inside RELION gets filtered to 30 angstrom because there's much fewer particles, while these ones get filtered to about 20 angstrom because there are many more particles. Okay? If you don't do that, you will never find this structure because it becomes just too noisy because there's only 600 particles contributing to it. Okay. Then, and that's work of this year. I've done my best to make this program as semi-automated as possible. I call this now 3D auto refine. So there's hardly any parameter that goes into refinement, and those present at the demo have heard this. So maybe basically it goes about what's the diameter of your particle and what's the initial low-pass filter, which I think should be pretty harsh as you can go, I would say, to avoid any problems with model bias towards the initial model, okay? But then angular samplings and so on get optimized inside the code. The point is that this is now a procedure which is easy to use, and there's not much room for tinkering. And if you've tinkered with your data for many years and you're good at it, that may be a bit of a change of mindset, okay? But here you cannot tinker. People say, oh, that's then a black box. I prefer to call it the transparent box, because the algorithm what I'm optimizing is very well explained in the literature, and all the implementation details are now as well. But yes, it is my philosophy that you should let this Bayesian theory make the decisions rather than you tinkering with all kind of parameters. But if you do that, I can still get, at least for these cases, reconstructions which are at least as good as other people had got, or slightly better, okay? So those are the maps, and that brings me back to the cleanness of non-overfitted maps, okay? These maps are just, they're very clean because there is no accumulated noise in them. The only thing that you have to do after the refinement converges is a B-factor sharpening, for which I use the Rosenthal and Henderson method, okay? But yeah, you can get sidechains with Relion, or Betagel goes to 10 angstroms on film, which we were quite happy with, okay? So then I have a poster with me today on this DNA origami object that I showed you yesterday, so please come and show it. That's also done with Relion. It's not more exciting, but this is more exciting because it's now not old data, but new data. And also the ADS ribosome structure I showed yesterday at 4.9 resolution was done with this auto-refine, although there we did divide all the particles into four frame averages. So it was just a bigger refinement, but not touching anything of the code. So this was just fully automated. My postdoc just ran it off. I admit it ran for 2 weeks on 150 CPUs, so it wasn't very fast, but the result was satisfying. And I think that non-overfitted cryo-EM density, we observe amplitudes and phases, so our maps should be really good. And people have compared our resolutions with those of X-rays. X-ray people, because they don't have their phases, often their maps look pretty bad at near the resolution limit. That, I think, shouldn't be the case in our case. And I now think if you have a good cryo-EM reconstruction, the density that you get should more or less look like a PDB model filtered to the resolution that you think your map is. Is that not? And this is the example for the ADS ribosomes. I think a different region than I showed yesterday. But if that's not the case, then something is still wrong, and I think you should worry about it. Okay? Then there may be unresolved heterogeneity. And I now show you this density is part of the large subunit, actually a small subunit. I showed you yesterday there was some regiting, and we tried to classify it. There's still some remaining flexibility there, and the 40S is still worse than the 60S, so there's still an issue with that map, okay? Or you've used a procedure that's prone to overfitting, or your initial model was bad, but you should worry about this. Okay, I'm almost finished. I hope you now appreciate what a difficult problem we have, also from a theoretical point of view, how you could handle this. Please be aware that initial model generation, but also classification, especially if there's a large number of different structural states or conformational states present, remain problematic, and I don't think we've really gotten to solve these problems yet. One problem I think we can completely avoid and should all avoid is overfitting. So I'm very optimistic that within 2 years we will not have any overfitted map deposited to the EMDB anymore. If you're a reviewer, you can help with that by asking for gold standard FSCs or high resolution limited refinements. And then, and that's my personal opinion, I think the Bayesian framework provides a very nice theoretical framework to do lots of to solve many problems in 3D EM. At least the models I have are explicit, and if you don't agree with the model, I may agree with you that I don't agree, then we can discuss a better model, and you can use the same theoretical basis to get to a more satisfying solution. But at least everything is out on the table. So that leads me to the acknowledgement slide. Especially Xiao Chen Bai, my very talented postdoc who collected these DNA origami and ribosome structures, and then all the people who have let me play with their data over the years. I've been without experimental people in my group for many years, and I've many people have let me play with their data, and I'm very grateful for that, because without that, some of this work wouldn't have been possible to publish as I could have. And then people who do the computing at our institute are getting ever more important as data size increases. And then some of the coding we rely on is actually copied from other open source programs, in specific XMAP and BSOF. So a lot of work has gone into that, which I've kind of copied over. So I thought I'd mention those as well. Thank MRC for funding and you for your attention.
Okay. You were mentioning the noise model, and I was always wondering how sensitive this approach really is to the precise details of the noise model.
Yes.
So if you don't, you know, you're putting in Gaussian noise maybe, or you are forced to work in reciprocal space, if you use colored noise, but then in real space you might not be able to do some things like masking or so.
Yes.
How important is it if your actual noise deviates from that?
So that's a very good question. I think it's very important. When we moved from white noise models to colored noise models, we saw a very, very big improvement. I don't think we're there yet. Gaussianity and complete independence and so on are all assumptions which are open for discussion. So I've thought about it, but I haven't come up with a better solution. So as long as that's the case, we'll continue doing this. But the nice thing is, in the whole framework, you can discuss these things, and if you come up with a better solution, which is also computationally feasible, which is often the problem, then you could do the potential gains again could be quite big. So yeah, excellent.
Pavel has questions. While we're doing questions, Dimitri, can you come and set up so that we can?
So, yeah, the question I have might be unintentionally silly. If you refine two maps at the same time,
yes,
which one is presented as a result, left or right?
No, so that's what I said. In the end, you add the two together, or you actually do a reconstruction from all particles. That
okay.
one you should then no longer use in refinement, but you don't have to choose between one or the other.
Okay. Now, something which is intentionally provocative. So as we discussed, the implementations that I did use separation between low-pass filtration and CTF correction, yes? And as I said, the low-pass filter is derived from FSC, which happens to be an analytical solution of the problem due to relation between FSC and SSNR. The reason it's done this way is to avoid pitfalls of iterations and excessively long time of calculations. However, what I noticed, if I'm correct, that in your iterative procedure, you also estimate SSNR. Is that right?
Yes.
Yes. Therefore, this you could convert back into the resolution curve of the reconstructed object. I was curious if you tried that, and
yes,
if yes,
no.
What that might be.
So there's two different approaches to the solution, and the first one is the one where you estimate the power of the signal from the power of the reconstruction you're doing. That's the official map estimation algorithm. Okay. Now, I still use that for classification, because if you refine two classes at the same time and you do that in two half reconstructions independently, then perhaps class A would be reconstruction one in the one half and class B the other, while in the other half refinement, it could be the other way around. You would have to check, and it would be a mess. Okay, so in classification, I still do that. Reliance still uses estimate of the signal from the power of the reconstruction, but that is, as you say, in principle, prone to overfitting. Okay, because it comes from a single reconstruction. So that's why when you do a high-resolution refinement, that you do this two half, then. So there is two different implementations. We classify using the first one, and we refine using the second.
Your procedure has implicit low-pass filtration, the iterative reconstruction.
Yes.
Low-pass filtration. Low-pass filter, which is implicit
Yes. So it's actually based then on the gold standard FSC curve.
Well, yeah, I'm curious how well this result agrees, which you had implicitly in the procedure, agrees with the one which you compute between 2 months.
Okay, so I never do both of them at the same time. In our hands, the one we use in the classification, which is in principle prone to overfitting, is tuned to such a way that in practice we actually stay a bit on the conservative side. The one in the refinement, but I think you misunderstand.
Yes. Yeah. Three more questions, then we're going to move on. Okay.
Good job, Shores. I wanted to ask, when you do this gold standard FSC, you're dividing the set data sets into two sets, and then you're creating two separate volumes. I want you to comment on how you have to align the two separate volumes together, right? Is that a difficult process in low-resolution cases?
Okay. So actually, Powell asked me that question half a year ago. So in practice, we don't see that as a problem. So if you start from 80 angstrom low-pass filtered ribosome, we don't see that one rotates with respect to the other. They stay the same, and I used to do nothing about it, okay? Then we got a case where somebody said, I have an icosahedral initial model, and I then want to refine it in C1 to see where a certain insertion part of the virus was. Now, those two halves converge to a different panton to be asymmetric. So what we did in that case, what you now can do in reliance option, if you have a C1 refine, because it's only in C symmetry that this can become a problem, then up to very low resolution, we actually average the two independent halves together. Okay, so up to that resolution, there is no gold standard whatsoever. You should be careful with this, and it's an option, but it does prevent things from happening. But in practice, we don't see a problem of maps diverging.
John, thanks for that clear presentation. Could you explain what is the advantage of integrating over all orientations versus something like Gibbs sampling, where you choose an single orientation with a probability proportional to its score, which I think would be equally Bayesian and much faster?
Have you ever tested it?
I've never tested it. I'm not sure you could do that, but yeah, perhaps, I don't know. I'll look it up. Interesting. Suggestion.
I have perhaps a trivial question. I also, it's a very lucid explanation of maximum likelihood, the most lucid I've heard so far. But there's this one term I have difficulty with, which is marginalization. It sounds to me like you're brushing something under the carpet. So is it a mathematical term? And can you explain what it actually means? Because, it's quite central to the whole thing.
Yeah, so the marginal probability is the one where you integrate over the entire domain of your missing or hidden variable, and you then optimize that function. So that, yeah, it's a term from statistics, which is, it is taking these probability weighted averages, the direct consequence of it. But it's that slide where I have option 1 and 2, where you optimize this probability where there is an integral over phi, that integration over phi, that's called the marginalization in some sense.
Ignorance of statistics.
Thank you very much for the great work.